Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Commutio Radio Network. I'm Jack Birkfeld, and coming up on the program...
Well, I think if you look at the estimated value of a company that could basically corner the transport services market, it's a very large number. I mean, some have suggested that it could be in the next 15 to 20 years, it could be worth $1 trillion. So the move.
You've probably heard of Uber and other new age taxi services, but on the whole, modern tech giants are yet to properly crack the transport market. We wanted to find out, how are they going to do it? Also on the show tonight...
If she is arrested or extradited to the United States for a trial, I'm afraid it will affect the trade negotiations.
On the 1st of December this year, Huawei's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, was arrested...
This week, the fallout from the arrest of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou by Canadian officials continues, with uncertainty over the future of the US-China trade deal and whether or not Canada will extradite her to the US on charges of sanctions busting. All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, casual workers will soon be able to ask for part-time or permanent positions after working at a business for 12 months, under proposed workplace reforms announced by the federal government. It comes after the Fair Work Commission released a report early this year supporting the casual conversion into full-time or part-time work. But some are questioning the timing of the government's announcement. Kevin Suarez has more.
The federal government has announced it will allow casual workers the ability to demand for part or full-time work after working in the same business for 12 months. Employers were allowed to deny the request on reasonable grounds, such as the business closing permanently in the foreseeable future, but could face legal action if they unreasonably denied the request. The announcement came half a year after the Fair Work Commission came to similar findings. Australian Council of Trade Unions Chief of Staff Ben Davison was critical of the Minister's choice to legislate on casual conversion, despite the fact casual workers have already won that right earlier this year.
Oh, look, this is pretty standard stuff from Kelly O'Dwyer, unfortunately. You know, we saw this with family and domestic violence leave, where the union movement, workers standing together, managed to get a win of sorts, not the total win, but get a win of unpaid family and domestic violence leave into awards through the Fair Work Commission process. And then, of course, Kelly O'Dwyer has come out and legislated pretty much the same thing. Ignored the calls to make it paid, which included calls from the Fair Work Commission to make it paid, and they made it unpaid as well. So it's not surprising to see Minister O'Dwyer come out after the fact, after the horse has raced off into the distance and say, well, I'm going to do this too.
While he approved of a changing attitude towards casual conversion within the federal government, he was unsure of the timing of the announcement.
This announcement came just days after Parliament rose for the year, and no legislation was introduced into Parliament. No discussion was had with unions. We're not aware of any discussion with business on this either. So really, given Parliament now won't sit for another 3 months, and there's already talk and rumours of it not sitting again before an election, it is a bit of smoke and mirrors from the Minister, but certainly an improvement in the rhetoric from the kind of crazy neoliberal trickle-down ideological ravings that we had before to at least trying to claim credit for other people's work.
Executive Director of the Australian Retailers Association, Russell Zimmerman, outlined his organisation's position on casual conversion.
The Australian Retailers Association has for some time been advising its members that they need to offer to their staff an opportunity to move from casual to part-time if they have been employed for 12 months or longer, and all new staff must be offered that same position once they have gained 12 months experience. In actual fact, from the 1st of January next year is the time when all retailers must have informed their staff by that date that they can change and request to move to part-time rather than on casual. And we are also advising our members that unless they have got extenuating circumstances, they must, in actual fact, give that staff member part-time if that's what they want.
Mr. Zimmerman was more supportive of the announcement and push for casual conversion.
The Australian Retailers Association supports the government in its move on that. Essentially, a retailer who is employing somebody for 38 hours a week should be offering them full-time work, and there would be very few retailers in Australia that would be giving their staff that are working 38 hours or close to 38 hours and offering them as casual work. Not all, but the majority of them would in actual fact be full-time employees.
He explained that he agreed many casual workers should be converted to part-time work and that casuals still had a role in the workforce.
They tend to take time off and maybe go away on overseas trips with their partners, or they may wish to have the extra 25% loading that the casuals receive purely and simply because they are saving towards something, or they may be university students that are quite happy to work but then cannot give a guarantee on the casual hours they are working because their university lectures change and they cannot guarantee their employment. So there are a number of reasons why people want to be casuals, and there are good reasons for those people who want to be casuals, and there should be a mix of all types of positions.
Mr. Davison says other changes still need to be made to the casual workforce.
What we're saying is there needs to be a clear definition of that. People need to be aware of their rights. They need to have proper rights to convert so that they're not stuck forever in an insecure form of employment where effectively their employer can get rid of them at a moment's notice and they have no rights to leave and no capacity to plan for their future.
He says giving casual workers the ability to ask for more permanent work is a good way to help resolve issues with insecure work.
We have a crisis of insecure work in this country. We have one of the highest rates of insecure and temporary work in the OECD. And we know that that affects people's ability to get wage rises. We know that that affects people's ability to get loans, to buy housing, to have a home, to get loans for cars, to plan their life, to have sick leave, to have paid holidays. So converting from casual to more permanent, secure work is something that people absolutely need the option to have.
Mr. Zimmerman says one other way to solve insecure work issues is to make part-time work a more attractive option to both employers and employees.
The Australian Retailers Association has a view that there could be an opportunity to give more flexibility to part-time workers. One of the big problems that we see with part-time is that if you wish to change the shift of somebody in the retail industry and make an alteration to their shift, you may have somebody who's ill, or you may have somebody on holidays, or for varying reasons you may need to change the shift. Officially, you have to give 7 days change of notice in writing to that employee under the General Retail Industry Award. It is our view that if there was more flexibility in the part-time provision, that there would be a long way more employees who would be happy and who would be accepting of part-time work.
He explained why it currently isn't a favoured option by employers at the moment.
One of the reasons that people don't want to take part-time work is because the employer is rarely wanting to flex them up in hours, because if they do, then they have to pay it at overtime rates. Some of those employees would like to work extra hours and don't get it, purely and simply because of the draconian rules and regulations around part-time work and increasing the flexibility for part-time workers.
Russell Zimmerman, Executive Director of the Australian Retailers Association, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. We contacted the Minister for Jobs and Industrial Relations, Kelly O'Dwyer, but she was unavailable for comment.
On the Money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
Tech companies have completely disrupted a lot of industries and fields: news, entertainment, politics, communications. But one industry remains elusive: transport. While ride-sharing companies like Uber have been successful, taxi-like point-to-point services only account for a fraction of overall transport. There is a lot more of the transport market that is yet to feel the impacts of tech, and a new generation of transport service technologies could be the key to tech companies cracking the rest of the market. This market could be valued trillions of dollars. Vincent Su spoke with Neil Sipe, Professor of Urban Planning at the University of Queensland, to find out more about why tech companies are even trying to take on transport and the impacts they could have.
Well, I think if you look at the estimated value of a company that could basically corner the transport services market, it's a very large number. I mean, some have suggested that it could be, in the next 15 to 20 years, it could be worth $1 trillion. So the move is really not for these tech companies to become transport providers, but they're providing a platform that they can basically let providers, you know, be part of that platform. But they actually do the routing, collect the money, estimate the fares and all those kind of things. So it's all about creating this platform, not necessarily actually providing the services, even though some of them, like Uber, is headed in that direction, but they are kind of providing a transport service with the cars and with their move into e-bikes and e-scooters. But I think their ultimate goal is to provide a platform kind of like Expedia is for travel. They kind of are looking to do the same thing for transport within urban areas.
So how much private money has been put into these initiatives so far?
Well, a lot. So not necessarily from Australia, but certainly a lot of venture capital is going into these companies, some established, some relatively new, some aren't even a year old, and some of them have values have attracted billions of dollars in venture capital. So significant amounts of capital in the space.
Transport as an industry is fairly dominated by government spending and government interests. And I guess this also goes back to the first question as well. But what's the interest from both venture funds and company founders in taking on an industry where the government fingerprints are pretty much everywhere?
Well, I think the move forward, the future could be that, you know, government could be the ones providing these platforms, but the view is probably not. And that's why you see some of these tech companies trying to partner with governments, with the government public transport provider. That is happening in some instances in the U.S. where basically they're trying to bring the public transport and private transport all onto one platform.
So what's the problem with the existing transport systems that these tech companies are trying to solve?
Well, I think that they are kind of new to the transport space. They haven't really been involved, but I think that they realize that clearly cars are the dominant form of people getting around in kind of most countries in the world where folks can afford cars. That seems to be where people are going and not using public transport because it's not convenient, doesn't take you where you want to go. You know, if you go across different modes or operators, sometimes the ticketing is not integrated, nor is the scheduling. So the goal is by creating this platform, we may not need to create a lot more infrastructure. We can actually provide pretty good public transport service for an urban area by integrating all the different modes that are out there into one platform.
But I guess you could also say that you could do that with existing technology. A lot of German cities, for example, they have an integrated regional transport authority that handles this sort of stuff.
But typically that is just across the public transit. You know, it might be trains and buses and ferries and the things that are typically under that public transport umbrella. And I guess what the new thinking is that they're bringing in a range of other modes like, you know, bike share or e-bikes, e-scooters, taxis, car sharing, ride sharing. So basically, you know, kind of expanding that view beyond the traditional public transport. And two places that have done this, one is Gothenburg in Sweden, where they did a 6-month trial and they actually got people to relinquish, if they did own a car, that they had to relinquish the keys to the car so that they could participate in this program, which was badged as mobility as a service. And that was a successful model, and it was then taken up in Helsinki. So those are a couple of places that have actually trialed this, and the Helsinki company looks like it's MaaS, Mobility as a Service Global, and they're operating there, and I think they're expanding into a few other cities as well.
How are tech companies trying to solve the issues of existing public transport systems? What are they doing? I know you mentioned that there's mobility as a service, but is there anything else to it?
Well, at this stage, I think that one of the big issues with public transport service is that it doesn't reach all the people that need to use it. And so there's this problem that's been around for a while that's identified as the last mile problem, which is basically, you know, people getting from their home to the nearest public transport access, and then from, you know, when they get off from there to where they happen to work or whatever their ultimate destination is. And so I think everybody's trying to solve this first mile, last mile problem. And we've seen initiatives that are, you know, in Brisbane a couple of weeks ago, the e-scooters from Lime appeared, about 1,000 of them. And if you listen to the folks that are behind these companies, their view is that Lime is trying to solve this first mile, last mile problem. And so if they can solve that, then that helps public transport operators, because then people don't feel like they need to get in their car and drive to a bus stop or ultimately drive to their final destination.
Are these solutions being put forward by tech companies? Are these the right solutions, or is it just hubris from these tech companies?
Well, I guess the argument, and I think this is an argument that's put forth not necessarily by these tech companies, but by a fairly broad spectrum of thinkers about the problems. And the view is that as we continue to urbanize and add lots more people every year, there's no way that we can keep up in terms of providing the infrastructure. And even if we had the money to do that, it may not be possible. So the view is that by trying to make a more efficient use of what's out there is one possible way forward that doesn't require a lot of money.
What sort of impacts will these tech companies have on our existing roads and public transport systems going forward?
There's a bit of unknown with respect to that question. If we move forward to thinking about autonomous vehicles, we could have a lot of autonomous vehicles running around without anybody in them, looking for rides and those kind of things. And that percent of those vehicles, it could be in the 10 to 20%. And so that's a lot. That would suggest that there needs to be some government intervention to prevent things like that happening. But if we just look at this idea about integrating services across a network, I don't really see a lot of downsides. I think I see more upsides in terms of providing better services for people to get around.
Neil Sipe, Professor of Urban Planning at the University of Queensland, ending that report by Vincent Su. I'm Jack Birkfield, and you're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Money. Ride the gravy train with us.
Over the past 2 weeks, the world has looked on as Huawei's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, has been arrested and accused of evading US sanctions on Iran, embroiling the US, Canada, and China in a geopolitical firestorm. While the timing is certainly suspicious, many are wondering if the entire arrest is politically motivated, with the US and China in the middle of trade negotiations. Daniel Ellison has the story.
On the 1st of December this year, Huawei's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, was arrested at Vancouver Airport en route to Mexico. Ms. Meng, whose father founded Huawei over 30 years ago, has been accused by the US Treasury Department of using the global banking system to evade sanctions against Iran. Ms. Meng had bail posted on her behalf this week in a Canadian court, and the United States has 60 days to file a formal extradition request with its northern neighbour. While the exact details of the alleged crime have not been released, the arrest itself triggered a sharp trading downturn in the US and Asian markets, and is threatening to derail the trade negotiations between Washington, D.C. and Beijing. In the days since, China has condemned the arrest and, in what appears to be a retaliatory move, has detained Canadian ex-diplomat Michael Kolvik without specifying cause. Additionally, while the US is yet to provide Canada with a formal extradition request, President Donald Trump has made the statement that he would intervene if necessary to ensure this case does not threaten negotiations between the US and China. This is an evolving story, and the fallout may not be apparent for a few weeks or months. I spoke with Professor Hans Hendrich, Professor of Chinese Business and Management at the University of Sydney and head of the University Business School's China Research Network. I asked how Ms. Meng's potential extradition might affect trade negotiations between the US and China.
It is too early to tell. It is seen as a very strong provocation by the Chinese. And if nothing happens on the US side and she is arrested or extradited to the United States for a trial, I'm afraid it will affect the trade negotiations.
The company at the center of the controversy, Huawei, has essentially been accused of being an agent of the Chinese government, with many countries, including Australia, considering following other markets by banning the company's hardware. I asked why there was a concerted effort to curtail Chinese investment in telecommunications, and Professor Hendrich pointed to the threat from China's entry into developing markets around the globe.
If China is able to move into less developed countries in Central Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, and occupy markets there, then in the end, there's no way to freeze out Huawei from future developments. And in the end, that is something that will have to be negotiated. But at the moment, it certainly looks as if the US is trying to block the technological advantage of Huawei and to keep them out of developed markets, which, of course, provide access to new technologies and to further development.
After the December 1 arrest of Ms. Meng, China warned there would be grave consequences for Canada if they refused to release her. On Monday this week, China appeared to make their move by detaining Michael Kovrig on a trip to Beijing. Kovrig is a former Canadian diplomat and is now the Northeast Asia Senior Advisor for the International Crisis Group. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has not condemned the Chinese response, stating it is up for the courts to sort out. However, Professor Hendrich believes China is following a particular pattern in their actions in arresting Mr. Kovrig.
It's hard to say that it's retaliatory, but everybody would guess that it is connected, because that's the way the Chinese normally tend to operate. They see these actions and arrests and so on as part of an exchange that's going on. So for the Chinese side, they themselves would see it as that.
In another twist to a remarkable story, President Donald Trump has also stated that he would intervene in Ms. Meng's case if it would assist trade negotiations. Her arrest coincided with the meeting of both Trump and Chinese Premier Xi in Buenos Aires last week as a part of continuing trade negotiations, and many are questioning the veracity of Trump's statement or ability to affect the outcome. Professor Hendrich, however, believes Trump will do what he can to ease trade negotiations.
I think the indications are that Trump, the president, will interfere. That's what he's indicated. There are opportunities on the Canadian side to make a case that this is somewhat politically motivated, which would enable them not to extradite. But I think the more likely scenario is that the president will intervene.
I asked if the arrest of Huawei's chief financial officer would have any direct impacts on Huawei's trading and their ability to function as a company.
I think the arrest as such will probably not impact all that much, but Huawei will see that as part of a concerted and coordinated campaign to either ruin their markets or bring down their reputation.
While it seems as though Ms. Meng's arrest gives Trump and the United States some leverage over trade negotiations, Professor Hendrich sees it as more of an obstacle to Trump's goals than anything else.
I think it's something that will put more pressure on him. But I think he might well be successful in achieving market access, achieving better prices for American services or better export prices, and somewhat reducing the trade deficit. That's quite likely he'll be successful there, because the Chinese have themselves indicated they are willing to compromise because they saw that coming.
Professor Hendrich also warns that any trade deal with China would not be a cure-all for China as a global player, and that issues such as intellectual property theft and state-run businesses would only be solved in the long run.
The trade deficit is not going to be resolved with fixing intellectual property rights or with giving access to markets. In fact, the trade deficit is not going to be solved in assortment because there's simply not enough goods that the United States could export to China to make up for their trade deficit. But what Trump is having in mind is to change global value chains and to reduce the role of China in global value chains by shifting productions to the US or to allies of the US, and to reduce the Chinese share in things like car manufacture and major industries.
But it would be hard to imagine Canada ever believing they would be so tentatively positioned in a conflict between the world's two remaining superpowers. I asked Professor Hendrich what the best possible outcome for Canada would be from this point.
Well, that's something where you can only guess, and my guess would be that they are trying to negotiate as much as they can to avoid an extradition with serious consequences for Meng Wanzhou, because that would bring retaliation. There's no question about that.
Professor Hans Hendrich, Professor of Chinese Business and Management, ending that report from Daniel Ellison. That's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Hello, if you're listening via 2Bob Radio in Taree or 7LTN FM in Launceston or ACCC in Alice Springs. Thanks to producers Kevin Suarez, Vincent Su, and Daniel Ellison. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find out about all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. To follow us on Twitter, look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook. I'm Jack Birkfield, and we'll be back next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Sydney's outdoor bed cinema is back. This summer at the Entertainment Quarter, Moore Park, watch a movie in bed under the stars, sip on a glass of wine and get food delivered straight to your bed by Fratelli Fresh or The Bavarian. Yes, you can dine in bed. Snuggle up and enjoy the latest blockbusters like A Star Is Born and classic movies like Love Actually. Forget the usual boring dinner date and take your partner straight to bed this summer. Book a bed at movieinbed.com. Sponsors of 2SER.
She's a bubble blonde, always meeting Mr. Wrong. Pam in the office with the pencil mustache, always short on cash. She's a real dreamer, wonders if the world is real. William Produce can tell her he knows a thing or two about everything, what to do. Natural.